If you've bought property, you likely funded your purchase partly through a mortgage. If the property increases in value over time by more than the cost of the borrowing, you're better off. In the stock market, using debt is often called gearing. The new BetaShares Wealth Builder Funds, ASX ticker symbols G200 and GHHF, offer moderate gearing across Australian and global shares for investors who are comfortable with the higher risks associated with gearing their investments. You can discover how they work by visiting betashares.com.au. Please don't forget that gearing magnifies gains and losses, so read the relevant PDS and TMD on the website and consider if the fund is right for you. BetaShares Capital Limited is the issuer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is a podcast by the Rask Group. It's for educational purposes only. So please do not make a financial, legal, investment or taxation decision based on solely what you hear in this show.
Welcome to the Australian Property Podcast.
We're on a mission to be Australia's most trusted property podcast.
I'm Owen Rask, founder of the Rask Group.
I'm Pete Wargent, author and buyer's agent.
I'm Amy Linardi, and I am a buyer's agent.
I'm Chris Bates, ex-financial planner and mortgage broker.
Together, we'll take you through every step of your property journey.
From first home buyer to decades of property investing. G'day, welcome to the Australian Property Podcast, our weekly 2 cents segment. I'm Pete Wargent from Alan Wargent Property Buyers, and I'm here with Chris Bates from Flint Group. Chris, g'day.
Pete, I'm doing very well. How's life on your end up the sunny coast?
It's pretty good. It's very wet. We've had probably 4 days of rain this week in a row, so kind of bored of that, to be honest. But yeah, what's happening down in New South Wales?
Oh, things are good. We're crazily driving to Melbourne for Easter to see my dad down there and spend Easter with my stepmom and all the kids, etc. So that should be fun. But yeah, 11-hour drive there and back in 4 days, probably not the greatest move, but we've committed now. So next week I'll be able to tell you how bad that was of a decision.
Yeah, well, it's a busy time of year down there, I guess. So with the long weekend and everything. So you can check in next week and see how that goes. So I was just going to do a little, this is something that your business partner, Christian, posted on Facebook, a bit of life hack for you. So I'm just reading from his post. I started doing 100 days off alcohol from New Year's Eve 6 years ago. It's completely changed my life. You're a more switched on version of yourself after just 40 days. Your motivation, time management and productivity skyrockets. The amount of work you can get through is crazy. You're calmer, more patient and communicate better under pressure. Any anxiety and stress you might have disappears and life is HD. Strongly advise if anyone's serious about getting ahead to give it a go. Chris, the reason this caught my eye is partly because I know you've been on a bit of a sobriety run. And believe it or not, last week was my 10-year milestone. So I think, like in my case, I was always a binge drinker. And I'd been I'd been self-employed running my own business for a few years, and it was going well at times, less well at other times. And then when we decided to have kids, I was like, right, I'm going to try to do a year off the grog. And since we've had children, I've just kept that going. And believe it or not, last week was 10 years for me without a single go on the terps. So it's been great as a parent, and it's just about, you know, trying to be the best version of yourself that you can be, as Christian points out. And life is a whole lot easier. Don't get me wrong, I still make mistakes and, you know, some things go well and less well, but at least you're being the best version of yourself you can be. And it's not because of a hangover that you get something wrong or you lose motivation. It's just, just because that's how life goes. So, how's your little run or stint going?
Well, yeah, I mean, I haven't been too public about it, to be honest. I think everyone's going on their own journey with, you know, alcohol, et cetera. I mean, if I go back, it was November last year. I'd done multiple runs in the past where I'd been off for 6 months, both pregnancies. I was off the grog with my wife as she, you know, wasn't drinking as well with the pregnancies. I thought that was a good opportunity to test it. I did feel better after it. So I kind of flirted with it a bit for a few years. And then, I mean, I was just turned 36, Tommy just turned one, and I just didn't feel healthy. And so last year I just said, look, I'm going to spend 2023 just getting fit and healthy and prioritizing my health, and not just not drinking, exercising more, you know, stretching, you know, going to see naturopaths, sorting things out like my hay fever, et cetera. And yeah, I got through the year. I thought, you know what, I still got unfinished business there, and there's a lot more I want to do with my health. And I think, you know, the interesting thing, we did a massive merger last year. There was, you know, basically two toddlers running around, and, you know, and there was a lot going on with work. And so I just felt, you know, much more stable and much more level-headed, I guess. And I think I wouldn't have potentially done this merger if I didn't have a clear head, because it was just a lot to think through. And I think that's one of the benefits, is if you can, you know, you've got more capacity, you've got more brain space, you've got more load that you can handle, I think, when you're not drinking. And but I mean, everyone's on their own journey. I mean, I would highly recommend it, you know, giving it a run. But, you know, I'm not judgmental if people aren't, I guess. That's sort of where I sort of land with it. I'm going to continue to do it all for the rest of this year. And, you know, to be honest, my heart says I'm probably going to do it again next year, whether it's for life or not. I don't know. But I'm just taking it year at a time, and that's sort of been my journey, but I would highly recommend it, giving it a go. It's not easy, because, you know, I think it's pretty easy for me because I've got two young kids. We basically don't go out for dinner. Yeah, we go to birthday parties on the weekends, but they're usually during the day, and they're four-year-old birthday parties. I'm not sort of single, or, you know, a young couple that, you know, haven't got kids. You know, there's probably a little bit more temptation at those stages of life to be out and about and socializing. So I'm doing it at a good time, but I think other people at other times would be a bit harder, just because the temptation would be there so much more.
Yeah, too right. Yeah, as you said, yeah, it's not judgmental in any way, shape or form. Anyone who knows me would know I was a massive binge drinker, and yeah, I never thought I'd be able to do a month off the grog, let alone a year. But yeah, times change and you form new habits. It's just something that caught my eye, because it seems to be, I've noticed Jack Henderson is another guy in real estate who's posted about it, and a few of the other younger buyers agents. It just seems to be an interesting trend that caught my eye. Certainly worth a shot. Yeah, if you're trying to sort of be the best version of yourself you can be, if you're running your own business, yeah, it's something that's worth a try, especially yeah, after Christmas and New Year's. So let's have a look at the top three stories making headlines in property this week then. So couple of different things. So something a bit different I picked up on a podcast. When is property ownership a trap? This was something actually from a while ago discussed by Chris Williamson on his podcast with personal trainer James Smith. And there was a bit of back and forth there about the pros and cons of being a property owner in the early part of your journey, and some of the potential traps and some of the benefits as well. So that's worth a debate. Secondly, AFR piece, good intentions are no match for housing supply reality. This is a Chanticleer piece. So sort of grim housing supply reality at the moment, and we're just not hitting the goals, and some forecasts there from Oxford Economic. And then thirdly, Mervac, we need landless mortgages, something we actually maybe mentioned on the show sometime last year, actually, some of these landless estates, and Mervac saying this is the way forward to get young people into property ownership. I think as we might have mentioned last time, there's some potential downsides there. Let's kick off with this first story. So yeah, podcast conversation. I had been listening to a few podcasts recently just to try and mix things up, and usually not property related, if I'm honest, but this one veered into property and finance, and therefore my ears pricked up a bit. So it was a discussion between a top podcaster, Chris Williamson, who is actually a landlord himself with a property portfolio. He lives in Austin, Texas these days. And James Smith, who's a fitness influencer or guru or a personal trainer coach in Bondi Beach, who prefers to rent for flexibility. And he said he would prefer to buy for cash later on rather than get trapped in with a big mortgage and so on. So I guess the question is, can, you know, stretching to get onto the property ladder become a bit of a trap, especially as James pointed out? Like, if you need two incomes to get into the suburb you want, to get the big mortgage that you need, and if you, you know, you're potentially then tied into a de facto relationship where you're both reliant on your job and meeting the mortgage payments every month. I mean, that could, in theory, restrict your ability then to pursue your passion, start a business, become an entrepreneur. And I suppose James's point was, you know, like that actually, I mean, that could be, well, the alternative for an entrepreneur is save your money to buy a house for cash later on, once you've grown your business. And the idea of owning a property portfolio, well, that can take up some time, cash flow, energy. So yeah, look, there's pros and cons to both. I took the view I'd rather just get some rentals because I did want to become an entrepreneur, but I wasn't really sure where I was going to be based, or, you know, would I stay in Sydney? Would I go elsewhere? Would I be based in Europe? So I just decided to max out my borrowing capacity and get a property portfolio happening. But there's, I suppose there's another side to that. The mortgages could become a trap.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting one. I see this with financial advisors who become very pro-shares, anti-property. And, you know, I think it's when you get this confirmation bias and you're all in on one wealth strategy, you sort of ignore that there's benefits to others. And can you potentially do all three, right? Can you be investing in shares? Can you be investing in businesses? Can you be investing in property? Can you be, you know, starting a business? Can you be growing a business? And I think what ends up happening is sometimes people think, oh, I'm going to go with one strategy and that's the best strategy. I'm going to put all my eggs in that and I'm not really going to consider other strategies. I mean, just coincidentally, I actually was sitting at a cafe next to James last year or something, and I was kind of listening to eavesdropping in on conversations, and I was, you know, listening to what they're up to and things like that. And I do think there's this belief sometimes, particularly people who have moved here from other countries around the world, where property is too expensive in Australia. It's a bit of a, you know, it's going to go down in value. It's not worth what it is. I'm just going to keep renting. I think it's a stage of life thing, really, to be honest. I think there's no real pressure for home security because you're happy to be in renting, you're happy to be in flat share. You know, where you live is not that priority because you want to live in, like, in terms of the actual house or the location, the type of property. You definitely want to live in an area that you want to live in. So in terms of the actual property you want to live in, not so much the location, you definitely want to still live in the location you want to live, but you're happy to flat share, for example. But as soon as maybe they get a partner or maybe you're thinking about having kids together, home security goes from really not that important to extremely important because you want to, you've got to think about kindies, you've got to think about schools, you've got to think about, you know, providing stability for your child, et cetera. And I think it's just a stage of life thing. I think James probably isn't at that stage of life where he goes, all of a sudden, oh God, I really do want to get housing security. My issue with this is that is if you keep on delaying it, particularly when you say you wait for cash and you can buy it with cash, is you've got to save up a lot of cash to buy a property outright, right? And particularly if he wants to live in an area that, like Bondi, for example, whereas he could have potentially still started the business. And as soon as he started to get a bit of runs on the board, potentially use that income plus with a little bit of cash to enter into the property market. And so I think there's an issue with maybe delaying it. I also think maybe it's an education issue. And what do you actually need to spend to actually get into the market? You know, he might be thinking you need a 20% deposit. You need to pay stamp duty. And the mortgage is going to be ridiculous. He has to live in it. So there's many other ways that you can sort of cut it to potentially enter on a smaller deposit and still keep that flexibility and that entrepreneurial spirit. But yeah, that is one of the issues, I think, with the Australian economy as we house prices get more and more expensive and we end up going in more and more debt. It does stifle innovation. And that would be one of the big, negatives to a hugely, you know, heavy property market compared to other asset classes like shares and things like that, which are seen more in the American economy. I reckon that we're stifling innovation. We've got less entrepreneurial spirit because we prioritize home ownership versus potentially starting a business and that entrepreneur lifestyle that I say was more common in, say, the US.
There's two sides to that, I suppose. And when you look at the ABS figures of how people start businesses, there's the friends, fools and family way of financing. But actually, quite often it's people using home equity as a way to get access to finance to start their business. So I guess, yeah, there's a couple of different ways of looking at it. You're right that the US is where the entrepreneurial spirit is brightest, and Australia sometimes has been a bit lazy, I suppose, in this regard. You know, big fat oligopoly businesses and people living off their asset price growth more so than sort of being genuinely creative and entrepreneurial. I think, the problem in the place like Bondi Beach, and, you know, when I looked at it, like all Brits, I lived in Bondi for 5 or 6 years. But if you follow the figures back, for as long as you can look, the house prices have doubled every decade. And sure, they could be different in the future. But realistically, it's one of the most popular places in the world to live. You only need to look at the sort of people in the house shares. You know, they've come from all over the bloody place because it's like a global village, you know. So that in itself tells you it's a popular place. There's no more land being made available. I used to know a famous cricket commentator about in Bondi Beach decades ago. And I remember he was a British Australian and saying, this is the one good financial decision I ever made was get a house in Bondi Beach because, the prices just keep on doubling. I think the risk is that if you spend all your after-tax money on, you know, cars, global travel, lifestyle, partying, wedding, you know, boats, golf clubs, depreciating assets, it's way too easy to spend everything. So I'm not saying don't do the rent vesting thing or, you know, you don't have to follow the traditional route, but the trap obviously is not buying somewhere to live, not buying a property to get on the ladder, and then just spending everything else because it's all too easy to do in the modern world. So there's always another country to go to, you know, a month in Bali, go to Koh Samui, you know, party time. But yeah, I think, my take on it was if I can build a property portfolio, then I've got the freedom to choose whether to work or not. And then, you know, then I can be an entrepreneur. So there's different ways of looking at the same problem. And everyone, again, you know, it's not a judgmental thing or, you know, you just got to choose your own journey and tread your own path. But I lent in favor of building the property portfolio because I figured, you know, that gives me the financial security. Now I can focus on doing what I want to do.
Yeah, and it's not to say that the return on equity or the return on investment's better in property than starting your own business. I would say you can do much, much better starting your own business. But sometimes you can potentially do that and then also do a property portfolio not too long down the line and then having all your eggs in a business. Or potentially you can do the property plus do the business, you know, if you know exactly how much to put in for the deposit and how to build buffers. And you know, the good thing is with property, though, is if you do take your time and buy a good asset, as soon as you hold it for a reasonable length of time, then as long as it covers the stamp duty and the selling costs and maybe you pay a bit of capital gains tax, you're not committed for 30 years. You are committed for a period, but it doesn't mean you're trapped away forever. And, you know, particularly it's a bit of a hedge. If prices do start to run on you, then you haven't got to sort of outrun it by other investing. So, whereas if the prices don't go up, okay, well, that's okay. You haven't been, you're not falling further away from the market. Maybe you could have had that money better invested in other asset classes, but the market hasn't run too far in you. But in this situation, if James doesn't invest, for example, and doesn't have any exposure to the residential market and it goes through a bit of a boom, well, good luck trying to outrun a leveraged up property, right? It's very hard to after tax to sort of out save it or out make more money in profit or business. And so that would be my concern in the situation here is just, you know, you don't have to be all or nothing. You know, I see this in people who buy shares. I'm not ever going to buy a property. Or I see people who do the opposite, have got way too much property and haven't even looked at other asset classes or their super. They've just completely ignored, other low hanging fruit. So yeah, that would be my overall takeaway, just having a quick squiz at that.
Yeah, very cool. So second article, this week, good intentions are no match for housing supply reality, AFR article in Chanticleer. So the first round of submissions for the Housing Affordability Future Fund closed on Friday. The plan is to deliver 1.2 million homes in 5 years for the government and apparently inundated with applications. So that's the good news. The first round of submissions kind of gone through and all the signs are that there's a lot of appetite there to build social or affordable housing in the first round of applications. That's great. I guess the flip side of the problem here is Oxford Economics says that although there's some really good intentions here, you're going to need an economic miracle. That's a quote. And in fact, I'll just read straight from the article. I wouldn't say you need an economic miracle, but you're going to need something pretty interesting to happen to reach 1.2 million homes over 5 years. The problem being 40% increase in construction costs, high upfront charges, we've got higher interest rates, savage competition for skilled labour from Australia's booming infrastructure sector, which faces a skills gap of, quote, about 230,000 people. And it's just the, I guess, the profitability of developers and builders is so poor at the moment that the construction supply is just not happening. The Urban Development Institute forecasts only 79,000 homes to be delivered this year. Oxford forecasts rental price inflation staying above CPI until 2026 and higher property prices. A lot of this, I guess, is driven by the record high population growth, which we saw reported again this week, mainly benefiting Southeast Queensland, Western Australia, but also Sydney and Melbourne. So, yeah, it's a familiar story. I think as well, because you'd have a better handle on this than me, but lending standards are just way too tight. Like, there's so many people who would like to, you know, get into buying a new home or building a home, but there's a very tight lending assessment buffer in place. And there's very little profitability, no margin for developers to build much at the moment either. And it's becoming absolutely chronic in this part of the country. There's 10 cities, inner city Brisbane, Caboolture's got an enormous one building up. And something's going to have to break here, whether it's interest rates, the lending buffer, or something's going to have to change, or prices are going to have to move, because at the moment we're in a bit of a stalemate.
Yeah, and I do think this is going to be a big conversation over the next 6 to 12 months. The budget's not that far away. There's already a lot of, Ross McEwan was coming out this week talking about the issues with our housing market. You know, Shane Elliott at ANZ. It's going to be a lot of pressure on APRA to relax the serviceability buffer, because the rhetoric is going to be is that it's becoming the haves and have-nots is going to get worse and worse, which absolutely is. The people in the market right now are on the medium to higher incomes. It's not as good a spread as it has been in the past. Intergenerational wealth's getting passed down to usually the people on the higher incomes as well. So it's snowballing right now. And I guess what they're going to ask to do is relax the APRA serviceability buffer so people on medium and lower incomes can start to enter the market, because based on their income, they just can't enter. Right? Maybe they do need to get some type of housing solution. And the problem is, even at current prices, developers can't make a profit. And so prices need to go up or costs need to go down. And, you know, whether building costs actually go down, whether it's labor or the materials, go back anywhere near, you know, how much of that 40% goes back? I don't know. You know, a lot of time in the past, building prices haven't fallen. And so I wouldn't be betting on that. Is this interesting that feasibility is becoming potentially better when Chris Minns says, you know, you can rezone locations around major traffic hubs, but that's usually not in the areas where, you know, those feasibilities, you know, stack up. You know, where you're most likely going to get builds through right now are in the more affluent areas of our capital cities. And they've still got pretty strict planning controls. There's not as many, you know, train stations and, hubs there. I would say that they're still heavily weighted to, say, the middle, the central to western parts of Sydney, not so much the lower North Shore or the beaches or the east. And so, that's where I think the feasibilities would stack up if they change zoning. But also in those communities up in the, you drive around the upper North Shore right now and all the bus shelters are, you know, complaining around this. There's, definitely Facebook groups on the beaches, et cetera. And in the inner west, all around sort of Roselle, there's all people fighting back, et cetera. So I think that's the real issue right now, that feasibilities don't stack up at the affordability end of the market. Plus, they can't borrow. And where they potentially could stack up, there's the NIMBYs fighting back against planning controls. And so, I can't see we get anywhere near this 1.2 million dwellings. I just don't know. Developers aren't going to build it unless they can guarantee profits. I mean, why would they? You know, particularly after the last few years where they've been really burnt and they haven't got the fund or their sort of liquidity buffer there, because it all got burnt in the last few years. And so I do think there's going to be a lot of pressure, though, for bank innovation, which is sort of leads a little bit into the third story. And I think not only assessment buffer is going to have to come down, I think we're going to start to see 40-year loans in the next few years to be
really commonplace. I think there's going to be other ways that they increase capacity as well. The tax cuts will help a little bit, but I think it's going to be when APRA step in and reduce that assessment buffer, plus maybe 40-year loans and borrowing capacities start to go up a lot.
You're right. At the macro level, it's almost like a game of chicken, isn't it? The regulators don't want to let anything go until the inflation battle's won. I guess you could argue in the most recent quarterly figures, CPI was only 0.6%, which is basically back at the target range. But year-on-year inflation is still above target. So they're hanging in there as long as possible. Reserve Bank's financial stability review showed that most households are coping with higher interest rates. There's about 5% of borrowers in negative cash flow. And so far, only about 1% are in 90-plus day arrears. But I guess the Council of Financial Regulators have noticed that there's been a material increase in financial hardship assistance. MASIC monitors that through its liaison program. So it's clearly, you know, the higher interest rates are starting to buy. There's still people resetting from low fixed rate mortgages onto much higher variable rates. So the sort of mortgage stress is building up, but nobody wants to let the dam burst until they can conclusively say that inflation is back to the 2-3% target or heading there. So yeah, we've probably got a way to go yet before things change. But yeah, you're right, Chris. Let's look at this third story. We need land less mortgages, says Mervac. Mervac says first home buyers should be allowed to buy in master plan communities without owning the land. Commonwealth Bank also seems keen on this. I suppose they would be, so they can write more mortgages. I guess like one of the benefits of allowing this, firstly, behavioural. I suppose if you own an asset, even if you don't own the land underneath the asset, from a behavioural point of view, you start to feel and behave more like an owner than a renter. But I've seen these things in the UK before, and they do come with some problems because you don't own the land, which is the appreciating part of the asset. You can end up with depreciation on the building. Sometimes, I'm not saying in all cases, but sometimes there's some very unfavorable terms for the owner, which isn't great. And also, I think just when you come to resell, you may find that you're selling into a pretty thin or a liquid market. And you, I suppose most importantly, it could be a trap because you may not be able to trade up to the next part of your journey. You might be stuck with a property you can't sell. It might be worth less than you paid for it. And then you're not really progressing in the same way as somebody who might have, say, let's say they bought just a one-bedroom unit or something to trade up. And it goes back to your previous point. There's a stage of life thing here, and it could work for some people. But, I think you need to read the terms and conditions very closely here because you don't want to own an asset that doesn't perform for you because you could just get stuck.
Yeah, I mean, reading through this article and, CBA thinking it's a great idea. I mean, is it really? I mean, is it really that we're at this point in the cycle where, you know, we can just lend to people on, you know, granny flats? And, you know, we used to discuss this on the podcast, I think last year around caravan parks and, are we able to? I do think there's, a need for somewhere to live, right? So, but it's kind of like a reverse mortgage. This is that, someone maybe has got the benefit of security and saying, I know I can stay here for the rest of my life. But basically what you're doing is you're going to wipe out whatever cash they did have because you're going to pay $150,000 for the building. And then that's going to, everything from the light switches to the roof's going to get older and older and older. That's going to keep depreciating in value. They don't get any benefit of the land going up in value. They'd have to have a pretty low mortgage. I mean, the bank wouldn't do a 90% mortgage or an 80% mortgage. I reckon it'd be more like 50 to 70% LVR and maybe on a shorter loan term as well. So it pays it off a bit faster as well. But I do worry that this is sort of what the next evolution of the housing market. How do we keep the property party going, the property Ponzi, sometimes people call it? Well, ultimately, that's what supports prices. If everyone rushed to sell, then prices wouldn't be worth what they are. But unfortunately, one thing that supports property prices is we need somewhere to live. And it's not like you want to sell and then it's hard to rent, et cetera. So, yeah, I do worry about the next evolution of the property market. What does it mean? I can see already families combining, kids with parents and grandparents. I think that multi-generational family is going to be a real common thing, whether that's a, and that's, I don't think that's a bad thing, you know, because potentially a lot of countries around the world do that. Yeah, what's your worries, I guess, over the next 10 years to keep property prices going? What's some of the things that we're going to see?
I think, well, actually on this specific point, I've seen, like firsthand, I can see there's a time when this can work. I know people in Britain who, and the land lease communities are popular in the US as well. So you're basically buying a new home on land where you're effectively paying rent. And the time I've seen this work for people is where if their spouse passes away and they want to free up equity, they just want security of tenure and they want somewhere cheap to stay and it's somewhere that's quite new or brand new. And yeah, they're downsizing, freeing up equity. They know they're going to stay there for the next 10 or 15 years. And they're not too worried about the capital growth or price performance. You know, that in that situation or for a retiree or a downsizer, yeah, sure. But what's happening here is that the banks and various other institutes and think tanks are saying, hey, this is an affordable housing solution. Yeah, I was going to say I'm less keen. I don't like it. I just don't think it's a good idea, to be honest. Like now, a Grattan Institute said, well, hey, this is no different to people putting down 5% on an apartment where you don't own much of the land. And that is, I think that's true. Like if you buy an off the plan apartment, I mean, how much land value do you really own there? You know, 2 or 3% of the asset value. I guess the problem is like by floating this as an affordable housing solution, you suck people into something where, you know, they take out a chunky mortgage with the expectation this is getting them onto the housing ladder. But it's not a ladder because you're not getting the price performance to keep up with the rest of the housing market. And then you're stuck, you know. So, yeah, I take the point. And, you know, the Urban Development Institute said, hey, you can borrow to buy a car. Why can't you borrow to buy these things? And it's like, yeah, okay, I take all the point. It should be available, I guess, to people. But as a strategy for a first home buyer, I just don't like it. Yeah, for a downsizer, maybe.
Pete, there's been a bit of a, I want to take a bit of a segue, a bit of a unemployment numbers dropped recently. And there's a, you know, around the world, maybe the yields are starting to pop back up a little bit. What's your sort of take on, are we likely to see rate cuts delayed? Are we likely to have higher rate for longer? Or do you think it's just a little bit of blip in the data and it won't take much for, you know, inflation to look really strong again? And yeah, maybe we don't need to be too much concerned about inflation running again.
Yes, so the labour force figures for February, suddenly, so we had December and January where the figures were just weirdly soft. You know, there was a massive drop in employment. I think what's happened is the seasonal shifts post-COVID are very different and the seasonal adjustments just aren't working. So in February, there was a massive rebound in employment, 116,000 on a seasonally adjusted basis. So that takes total employment to about 14.25 million for the first time. And then you saw the unemployment rate suddenly went from 4.1 to 3.7 in a single month. So I think, look, if you look at these figures, like you don't want to put too much weight on monthly figures, just follow the trend. And if you look over the past 6 months, unemployment rate has been roughly flat. And the leading indicators, if you look at job advertisements with companies like Seek, or even just the government's own figures from Jobs and Skills Australia, the labour market's softening. Hours worked are lower than they were a year ago. Hiring is going to slow down. I think, yeah, the unemployment figures were really unusual for February. But if you just take a smooth average over the past 3 months, yeah, the employment's growing about 20, 23,000 a month. That's lower than would be needed to keep the unemployment rate down. I think to your point, though, yeah, I think there's not going to be any interest rate cuts while the unemployment rate's 3.7%. So, yes, I would say push out any expectation of an interest rate cut to the final quarter of this year, probably. Australia's 3-year bond yield is about, what, 3.7%. So I don't think it changes the medium-term picture, but for this time being anyway, and this is the same for probably the US as well and other countries around the world, yeah, just push out some of those expectations of central banks sailing to the rescue, because actually the economy's held up pretty well overall.
Yeah, and you see on the ground, there's some pretty strong bidding and strong competition on properties. I mean, it sounds like the papers again have flipped saying, oh, no, market's cooling, you know, things, auction clearance rates aren't as strong. And then bang, all of a sudden, one good round of numbers again. And everyone's like, oh, there's FOMO. Everyone's trying to get in before rate cuts. And yeah, what's your take on, I guess, stock over the next month, right? Because Easter's this week and then you got school holidays and it's a real tough time to know when to list your property. I feel like that maybe there was a bit of front running of listings. I guess people came back after the new year. There's a little bit of heat in the market. Everyone's surprised. Okay, well, why would I, if I want to sell, I'm actually better to sell in March or February rather than wait for April when there's school holidays and Easter and things like that. So there was a bit of an increase in supply from just looking around myself. They went, oh, actually, there's a bit on the market. But I think a lot of that is going. And maybe the next few weeks is not going to be much coming on. And all of a sudden, we're getting to sort of May, June, which is when listings really dry up. I mean, what's your take on what you're seeing in Brisbane? Is it been a bit of a supply hit? But ultimately, that's all got gobbled up. And we're going to be in this situation where people are looking, you know, with limited options.
Around the price point, I guess 800, 900, mid nines, there's so much competition around that price point that anything good is getting, you know, multiple offers, multiple bids. I'm not sure it's the same right across the market. I understand Perth is the same with half of properties aren't even making it through the first open home without being sold. So Perth is obviously in a boom phase. But yeah, I think in other parts of the country, Sydney and Melbourne, it's patchy, I think. You know, it's, some properties are achieving big prices and record prices in some cases. But yeah, I don't think it's as clear as the market's really strong. But yeah, I don't think the, yeah, I mean, we're, where are we? We're nearly into April already. And yeah, the sort of those months of the year around the middle of the year is not traditionally a time when listings pick up. So yeah, I think we're probably just going to sort of muddle through over the next 6 months. A lot of people are just waiting, you know, to see what happens with interest rates. But yeah, I think if you just look at what markets are pricing, it's pushing things further out, but the next move is still expected to be down. It just might be further away. So yeah, look, it's a mixed picture around the country, but certainly in Brisbane, we've, you know, just seen lots of competition around that those middle price points because you've got first home buyers trying to get into the market, a lot of them using parental assistance because the rental market's tough. Yeah, it may be patchier in some other parts of the country, though.
Yeah, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what comes on over the next 3 or 4 weeks. Oh, I reckon listings are going to be pretty tight and everyone's going to be like, oh, I, you know, when I was pressing the refresh button on Domain Real Estate over the last few months, or last month or so, I'd been like, oh, this is pretty good. There's quite a bit coming on. And then things dry up and then it's a game to list your property in sort of May and June. It really is. You know, you've got you know, winter there. And so unless your property presents really well in winter, you don't really want to sell it. And a lot of buyers really sort of calm down and they wait for sort of spring for the next run of listings. And so, yeah, it's just crazy how fast, you know, time moves. And that window when you felt like there was a lot on the market and then all of a sudden there's not again. And then you got to wait another 6 months and news can change. The confidence behind the market, the momentum, the sentiment can shift a lot in a few months. It happens over that Christmas break, but it also happens over the winter break. And so if you find that, you know, you don't transact in sort of April or May because it's very low listings and you're waiting to August again. And who's to say confidence around rates doesn't bounce, doesn't increase. And then all of a sudden people are chasing the market again. And so, yeah, that'd be my take at the moment. I think there is a little bit of stock on the market, which is a great thing for a buyer, but don't assume that that's going to continue for a long time. I would say that the market's completely frozen up and there's a supply shortage of good properties just because people are stuck in them now and they can't actually upgrade even if they wanted to.
That's a fair call. So, okay, let's wrap up on those three stories this week then. So when is property ownership a trap discussion between Chris Williamson and James Smith? I guess this is a property podcast and we're biased towards real estate, partly through our own experiences. But yeah, my view on that is I don't think owning a property has to stop you being an entrepreneur. It doesn't mean you have to become a landlord and spend your weekends arranging for property managers to fix sinks and so on. But yeah, I think there can be a potential trap to not buying anything. And then especially in those eastern suburbs of Sydney where the demand is just ongoing and there's very little supply. So, I would be biased in favour of getting a foothold personally. But Everyone has to tread their own journey on that one. Second story, good intentions are no match for housing supply reality. I think this is just a building story, isn't there? The construction is no way keeping pace in the housing market. There's stacks of competition from things like infrastructure projects. You got Western Sydney Airport, Melbourne Suburban Rail Loop. There's all these mining projects and infrastructure things happening. Loads of competition for the trades and workers and just not much margin for developers. And yeah, it's creating massive issues now, real rental shortages, dwelling shortages building up. And then thirdly, potential solution, we need landless mortgages, says Mervac. Well, I just don't think it's the answer myself. So yeah, there's certainly some benefits to that, maybe for a downsizer or a retiree, but I just don't think it's the answer to affordable housing. So I think that's about it for this week, Chris. So started the episode talking about vices. Biggest vice these days for me is coffee, so I think I might go and have a refill. So any plans for the rest of the week for you?
Oh, just knuckle down till Thursday and then dread the 11-hour drive to Melbourne. So I look forward to catching up everyone after Easter, and hopefully we survive the drive. It sounds a bit morbid, but I'm sure we'll survive it, but maybe with a few scars. So thanks so much, Pete. Hope you have a good Easter and happy Sunday for everybody. And hope you're having a great time with your families.
Cheers. Drive safely. See you next week.
Thanks, Pete. Cheers.
Thanks for tuning into the Australian Property Podcast.
If you love the show, why not subscribe or leave us a review on Apple or Spotify?
And if you want to work with me, Amy, Pete, or Chris,
you'll find links in your podcast player to get in contact with us.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Australian Property Podcast. We're huge advocates of getting the right advice at the right time from the right people. That's why it's important to understand that this podcast episode contained general financial information only. It is not designed to be specific or personalized to your financial, tax, or legal situation. With property, the check sizes are pretty big, so it's important you get advice from a licensed and trusted professional before acting on the information you hear in RAS podcasts. Thanks again for listening.
For more than a decade, I've been hunting for the best investors and their methods, strategies, and tools for investing. After years in the industry, countless books, a few degrees, and 1,000 podcasts and live shows, I've rolled this accumulated knowledge into something called RASC Invest. If you've ever heard me talk about a core and a satellite, active and passive, true long-term compounding, or you simply want to know exactly how I would invest, now is your chance. RASC Invest is our new investment service, designed for all types of investors who want professional management of their core portfolio at a low cost from a team they trust. RASC Invest helps you automate your wealth creation and passive income. Simply click the link that says Invest with Owen in your podcast player to join one of our live platform walkthroughs or book a call with us. You can also view the RASC Invest PDS and TMD and get invested with me.